somebody told me, you know, there's a guy coming from the States. He's training mediation. I don't know what mediation is, but I think it's good for you. Go for it. So I went to it, and I will come back to it later in this talk, but it changed my life, basically.
At that time, there was almost nothing else in conflict resolution.
Your workshop gave answers to all the three areas of making sense with your life.
And to this day, I still believe that if that National Peace Accord had not been set up with all those layers of conflict resolution capacity, I don't think South Africa would have achieved what it achieved. Realizing that, by the way, was an important one for me, because I spent years kind of puzzling over the question, kind of exactly the one that you're asking now. You can have social change, or you can have credit for social change. You can't have both.
What would be your message to people who are really kind of troubled by the state of the world?
Mediation Mindset. Konflikte nachhaltig klären. Der Podcast von und mit Tilman Metzger.
Hello, Ron. It's great to see you after 40 years of time. I'm enthused to see you. How are you?
I'm doing very well, Tilman, and it's really good to see you. You look a little different than the last time I saw you.
but you don't look different at all.
Lovely to see you. I'm really pleased. And it was really nice to go through your website and see what a beautiful website you have. And also the work that you're doing sounds meaningful. So congratulations.
Oh, thank you. Oh, thank you. That's very, very kind. And of course, we'll come to your work. And I'm really enthusiastic about listening to you and what you have been doing the last 40 years. And where are you right now? You're living right now in the States at this moment, or where are you at the moment?
Yes, I'm in Silver Spring, Maryland. It's a suburb of Washington, D.C. If I rose straight up from my house about 100 meters, I could probably see the Capitol building about 5-6 miles away.
Right in the center. That's great. Well, I am here in Lüneburg, which is close to Hamburg. So I'm a northerner. I was born in Hamburg and still in the region of Hamburg after traveling around a bit. So it's great to have these techniques.
Morgen Hamburger.
Yes, exactly. You speak German a little, I learned. Is that right?
I do, yeah. I spent a year there when I was a young man, and a fantastic year. I really enjoyed it.
Great. Where have you been in Germany?
I lived in Kassel. I studied in the Sprachschule in Kassel, and then in Aachen on Diemelsee. I worked there in Tiefbau for several months.
Tiefbau, wow.
No, sorry, not in Aachen. That was in Villingen.
Okay.
In Aachen, I was in the Technische Hochschule.
Oh, great.
As a guest student.
Well, that's fantastic. Well, that's really nice. It's rather rare that US Americans speak German, so you are once of a small kind. That's great. Ron, why do we talk with each other? Well, basically, we already said it. We met almost 40 years ago. That it was in March 1985. And you then came to Belfast and to the northern part of Northern Ireland, to Corrymeela, a peace center in Northern Ireland. And I was then a young guy working at Northern Ireland. And somebody told me, you know, there's a guy coming from the States. He's training mediation. I don't know what mediation is, but I think it's good for you. Go for it. So I went to it, and I will come back to it later in this talk. But it changed my life, basically. You really changed my life. My life would be totally different without you. And the amazing thing is that we really haven't met since then, since 40 years. I think we once had a brief contact via LinkedIn, but that it is. So when I came to think about making a podcast and what should be in the first episodes of the podcast, I felt, well, I should ask Ron. I mean, it started with Ron. For me, it started with one. So I felt I wanted to talk with you and hear what's about you. So,
wow, that's fantastic. It's hard to describe how that makes me feel, because that is exactly the kind of story that I gives my life great meaning. It's exactly the kind of thing that I have hoped to see my life being about, namely to be planting seeds in many places. And it's really heartwarming for me when someone comes back to me 40 years later and says something like that.
When it was said, when he could talk about seeds, I was then singing as well in the choir, which was sponsored by Coromila, and we had a song there, which was the theme song of the Coromila choir, and said, "Let us spread the pollen of peace throughout our land." That was the so that's what you're talking about. We're spreading the pollen of peace, isn't it? And so, so I'm very thankful to you. And so I would like to just to give you and listeners a brief overview of what this is about. I would love to hear about your experience of mediation of the almost last 50 years, as far as I get. And of course, I would like to hear a little bit more about how we met and what it meant to you. And I would, of course, say something about me as well, how, what it meant to me. And as well, I'm very interested, after looking at some of your highlights of your mediation work of the last 40 years and probably some of the challenges, I would be as well very keen to look together with you into the future of mediation, the next 10 and 20 years. What where should we go? Where do we need change? What may be the role of mediation in the future time? So that's about 70 years in about 60 minutes or 90 minutes. Let's see.
Sounds great to me. It's my favorite topic. So
that's great. That's great. And maybe start with 1985. What kind of guy was Ron Crable in 1985? What made you come to Northern Ireland?
I think we'll start historically to respond to that question. 85 was a time when in the United States, which was my primary location of viewing the world, we were still coming out of a very traumatic period. There was World War II, there was the Korean War, there was the Vietnam War, there was the Civil Rights Movement, and there had been a lot of struggle in that time and an enormous amount of turmoil. And I think there were several things that were influential for me in that time. The one was I personally had older brothers who were in the demonstrators against the Vietnam War, and that very much influenced me, and with a sort of an activist feeling that we ought to be challenging conflicts in the world, making peace.
Interesting.
And there was a larger sense that, well, we are discovering things about peaceful change through these movements for change that are quite powerful. And we could maybe do more than this. I also came up in the Mennonite Church, which is one of the historic peace churches. And that is a church that had taken a stand against participation in war for generations.
Yeah.
And that was
and,
very
and
much...
you were you born into the Mennonite Church, or did you join it as a youngster?
I was born into it. My parents were Mennonite farmers in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, which is one of the oldest Mennonite settlements. And so I was very much in that very small world. But the Mennonite viewpoint was we don't participate in war. That was kind of the end of the statement. And it's a good start. But at that time, with an activist influence from my elder brothers, wanted to do more than just say, no, we don't take up weapons.
Actually, we share something a little bit. I was born into a Baptist family. In a Baptist family, which is rare in Germany, actually. We're a very small community of about 40,000 people then. And I was one of the only 400 members of the peace movement of the Baptists, Fornert.
Oh.
And of course, the majority of Baptists then said, well, you only have to pray. If you want peace, you have to pray. Don't go into the street. You know, this is earthly. Yeah. This is yeah. worldly. Just pray. Yeah. And so it's some similarity there as well. Felt no, praying's not enough. and as well, I felt like you. We had in 1983 this big peace movement thing with rallies of about 400,000 people in Hamburg in the marketplace, and I was part of it. Then this was then against cruise missiles and Pershings, like against nuclear armament. And when then the decision was made that Pershings and cruise missiles will be put into Germany, the whole peace movement collapsed. So it didn't exist anymore in 1984.
Yeah.
And I felt, well, this is not possible. I mean, it's even more reason to work for peace when nuclear weapons are there. So I really felt like this is not possible. So that's interesting. Yeah. Kind of a similar impulse there to do something, obviously. Yeah.
It's one of the examples of ways in which these small religious-based movements, although they often get criticism, for being too withdrawn or whatever, and I share some of that criticism, but they, in their own way, sometimes contribute to the formation of important ideas, either for individuals or even for whole movements.
Yeah. I read that in 1979 you graduated, and did you from then? What did you do after 79? Did you work with mediation in the States, or did you go right away abroad? What happened with you after 79?
I worked in the States. The Mennonite churches in the late 70s were increasingly aware of the limitations of non-resistance, as we called it back then, as the expression of our convictions, and were beginning to experiment with ideas. How could we become more proactive in responding to conflicts in the world around us? And I was called as the first director of a new initiative by the Mennonites called the Mennonite Conciliation Service.
Right.
It was established by Mennonite Central Committee, which was a small relief and development agency that had a lot of international experience. My mandate, though, was to work in North America and to work as a resource to the North American churches and surrounding community. The international work then came some 10 years later.
Some later, yeah. Actually, in 1994, I've been to the States for about 7 weeks doing research on mediation work in the States. And one part of it was, I think, a five-week training in Akron, Pennsylvania with the Mennonite Conciliation Center on conflict resolution. So I obviously, you have been based at Akron then as well, or where were you based?
I was based in Akron there, and I was the first director of that agency, and I developed that whole training program you would have been in. Of course, it went in other days later, but that was my launching pad, because that was my first job in conflict resolution, and it was incredibly exciting. At that time there was almost nothing else in conflict resolution, a few things here and there, the Quakers and a few things that the U.S. government was experimenting with in the Justice Department, but it felt to me like an opportunity. I was coming into a new, very green field, totally unplowed. I was certainly not a good farmer in this field myself. I had very little actual skilled training. I had ideas, but I didn't have experience. And so I was simultaneously in those years teaching myself, learning how to mediate with a few small mediation cases between neighbors, and then began to get into church fights. And then other people wanted mediation skills training and training working with organizational conflicts. And so I developed training materials and then trained trainers. It was so exciting. I'm very grateful for that period of my life.
Sounds very familiar to me. And obviously then you were part of this community mediation movement, which started there in the end of the 70s, really. It sounds like it, like neighborhood fights and stuff like this.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Because
that was...
Because the other early teacher I had about half a year later, he as well came to Northern Ireland, was Ray Schoenholz from the San Francisco Community Boards Program.
So
this I found very interesting as well to learn about there. And actually my first steps in Germany with acting as a mediator in Germany was in community mediation. Actually, I founded a community mediation center here in Lüneburg, where I'm living still. So similar
stuff. Is it still going?
It's still going without me since I left it 1999 because I wanted to focus more on conflicts within businesses. That's what I'm still doing, actually. But I built it up, and we had about 4 employed people and about 20 volunteers working then, and they're still going very well. So I'm really happy that it's still going.
There's hundreds of those little community mediation centers now in many places. They're all sort of struggling. Nobody gets rich or famous, but it's an important demonstration of possibility.
Of course, and I learned that especially in the United States, many of the high-profile mediators of today have learned in the community mediation centers. So this really a very important place there. I learned that at some stage you had 500 community mediation centers in the States. Amazing. I mean, things little less today, as far as I know, but it's amazing. From starting in the Mennonites Conciliation Center in the end of the 70s and then coming to Northern Ireland in 1985, what make you go to Northern Ireland? Was it already boring in the States? Was it already established? Or what was it that you felt, well, I should go abroad? What happened with you?
One of the gifts for me of that time was that the Mennonite Conciliation Service was founded by an international development organization, the Mennonite Central Committee, which had, the staff around me were working on throughout the world in various locations and had a big vision for possibilities. And one of the units of MCC was the MCC Europe unit, which was paying attention to a tiny organization, not a lot of money, but they were looking for how do we support the emergence of peace builders in the European context. And there was some longstanding connection to people in the Northern Ireland situation. And they were noticing individuals there who were trying to work in a bridge building way in that long running conflict. So they became aware that there was some burgeoning interest in Northern Ireland to build a network, local and regional networks for peace, and then thinking through, well, how could we assist this? And then probably came as a request from Ireland, I'm not sure. Well, if you could provide us some training, that would be useful. So who do we have? Well, Ron Crabo is doing it here in North America. Let's send him. For me, it was very exciting. It was my first foray outside of the U.S., and it was really an exciting expansion of my world.
I think we were about 20 participants, and of course some British, some Northern Irish, Protestant, Catholic. Then there was me as a German. Do you remember how did it feel to you to train this bunch of people? I mean, must have been a little different from what you've done in the States, or was it all the same to you?
It was both of those. The thing that was the same was that something I'm sure you understand, Tillman, is that sense of solidarity and common purpose. When you gather people, human beings together to address the reality of conflict, there is an instinctive understanding of how special, unique, I would say in terms of spirituality, sacred it is to gather with this agenda. This agenda is where human beings destroy each other emotionally and physically. It's also when we're able to make progress on this topic, we understand instinctively that 1 meter of progress here is actually an expansion of human capacity, that this is about our very highest and best when we can address painful conflicts constructively. And that understanding, we all carry that when we come into a gathering like that. And if we've been working on it in our own communities, we've been feeling lonely about that agenda. There's not a lot of support for this in the world. And I instinctively felt that sense of community when I came there to that Cori Míle gathering. Here were people, in another continent who understood instinctively what this was about. And I didn't need to be defending why maybe we shouldn't be just smiting them harder, which is the common instinct in conflict. So I felt so lifted up by that. And then you're there from Germany. And there is, though, another dimension that I also experienced, and it's one which across my life I see as really the big challenge for the movement of what we call mediation and conflict resolution. Namely, we have been able to make our best progress as a movement at the interpersonal level, working with the simple realities of neighbors and business disputes and so on. It's not simple, actually. You can get your arms around it in a certain way. And this was my first training for, well, not exactly, because I had had some experience in connection to people involved in the American Civil Rights Movement, for example, where those are structural issues there and many profound, complex structures involved. But still, I had did not have a lot of experience with a conflict which is centuries old and involves layers and layers of accumulated ideas and structures and cultural patterns, etc. And so that was daunting to be working in that context, bringing tools that I very much believed in from the interpersonal context, but had not, I had not yet complexified that the skills that I have to take them out in easily into the larger world.
I mean, obviously it was the, I suppose, the regular interest-based mediation model as it works in the States, and you taught it to us as people who have got conflicts with other people. So it wasn't really about how do we solve the Northern Ireland conflict, but it was just basic mediation training. And for me, it was great for several reasons. The one reason was I talked about my frustration with the peace movement that it collapsed in Germany. And I really since then looked for a way to really practically work for peace, because I got disillusions about walking around the streets. I felt we need to do something. So I really was looking for doing something. And I was a little bit lost what to do with my life, really. I was a very, very good student at school, and I wanted to do something meaningful, but I didn't know what really. So that's what I was looking for. And the other thing was that my parents were born in 25 and 28, so they really lived through this Nazi crap and really suffered under it. I mean, they were just regular Germans, but they were rather, for several reasons, more distant to it. And they talked very openly to me and my sisters and my brother about what happened then and what kind of responsibility we've got that this don't happen again. So this was another big thing. And on top, being a very good student, I really managed to have lots of enemies. I wasn't a good friend of members of my class. I was really interested in having good notes and having success at school and was really isolated, I feel. So I really knew since some years at school that there's something I have to learn in communicating with people, really. And so I was really looking as well on a personal level for something. And this was so amazing that being at your workshop, I think it was about 5 days. I'm not sure anymore. I didn't write down. I know it was in March. I think about 5 days probably. And it gave your workshop gave answers to all the three areas of making sense with your life, of responding to what happened in Germany during the Second World War and before, and coping with my own inability to handle conflicts, really. So it was like it was similar, like you told me just now what the study in Harvard meant to you, like this kind of a bang. I know what to do, and so it's really I was sure that right in and after this workshop, I was sure that's my thing. I will do it. Not that I'm really good at it yet, but I that's my thing. I will do it. So this for me was a big start. And I had then another 9 months. It was only in the beginning of my staying in Northern Ireland. So during 9 months, I missioned many people about mediation and started training and stuff without knowing a lot, but really working there with the Fellowship of Reconciliation then. And so we had different ways of promoting mediation there then. It was bit of my job there as well. So this is what it meant to me. So thanks a lot.
It's really wonderful to hear that personal account, because and there's a lot in what you just said that I think illustrates the how I've understood our challenge in building a peaceful world. And I would start maybe with the kind of hopelessness that people feel about doing anything about conflict. It's like, it's everywhere. It's overwhelming. I can't fix it. So in the end, people do nothing. I think peace starts with vision and hope. It starts with people who are connected to the realities of life around them, who have a vision for a different way of solving conflict. And you're a fantastic example of someone who, well, as I am too, actually, because I came into this also as a young man with no sense of how I was going to live out this vision. I had no clue. All I knew was I feel this incredibly strong inner attraction to the idea of peacemaking and being involved in that. And I'm just going to walking towards this. And I hear in you a similar kind of response. There were not a dozen job offerings out there sitting, jobs for you waiting if you just get training. That wasn't the way you came into it. You responded to that inner call. There are people like this in all over the world that I see. And that is a part of our, an important part of our task is to give those individuals the call. And it doesn't take a whole lot because the call is already in them. They just haven't had an opportunity to hear it yet. And it's like that you go to a workshop or you see something and some light goes off, and there are individuals in every community who receive that call. Mm. And a second thing is to recognize that peace isn't achieved by coming with the bright solution or having all the answers. It's a journey, it's a process. And what matters is for us to get on that journey, to take the next step towards where we want to get to. I think about this right now a lot because I have twin sons in Tel Aviv who were on the receiving end of an incoming ballistic missile from Iran in the last few days. We're in an escalating spiral. Israel has very aggressively attacked neighbors who've been fighting it, and repeated actions, and it triggered then this reaction from Iran. And this is very, very dangerous right now. It could be the start of something that could devastate millions. So I have a personal stake in this. My family, my twin 15-year-old sons are in Tel Aviv. I worry about them every day. And I think about how can we ever get out of this situation, and I feel in certain, depending how I look on it, I feel hopeless. And this is a time when I keep reminding myself, you don't have to have all the answers and the whole big, you don't have to have a big peace process here to put on the table to contribute. We have to look at things long term, and we have to take the next step. What can I do?
Yeah, I must admit that the recent 2 or 3 years, I feel as much hopeless as never in my life. Kind of world do I leave to my grandson? I really feel a little guilty, although I tried all my life really to make a, you know, to make a contribution really, and I feel like so it's a big task to get on the journey and keep on the journey, stay the journey, really.
It touches on something we may go into later, but regarding the current state of mediation conflict resolution, just to say a sentence or two now, I think that you and I came up in a period that was very much shaped by the liberal Western optimistic view of history. Yeah. Everything is getting better. Yeah. And there's very wonderful things about that in certain ways, and I still am somewhat influenced by it. But it's in the end, it's there's some naivete, or we could say ignorance, in that worldview. I think the conflict resolution movement that I was a part of, that you have been a part of, was very much focused. It was excited about these skills and spreading the skills. It's extremely important to do that. We're not going to get change in the world towards peace without vastly expanding awareness of those skills and teaching people how to use them. But there's something else that for me now is much clearer than it was 30 years ago, namely that it's not just a matter of skill building. It's a matter of building human beings. It's a formation. It's personal formation and organizational formation, national formation. It's not enough just to go out there and teach mediation skills. We need to nurture individuals like you and many others who are out there who feel deeply called to this and are not just using these skills and as an instrument to make them better human resources managers, great use of the skills, but real change, sustainable change in our world will come when there are people who are saying, this is at the essence of my life, living out this vision for peace. I examine everything that I do through the lens of healing and reconciliation and what it takes for human beings to achieve this in our relationships with each other. And that means I'm looking at how I'm living with my family and neighbors and my religious community and how my government deals with conflict. There's just a whole vast web of things, and we need individuals who are deeply called to be asking those questions and trying to come up with the answers.
So it's really about the whole way of life, as much as I suppose structures. I mean, how as a society are we organized, and how do we deal with things as well on a bigger scale and larger scale? And I would be at this point, probably, is that a good point to divert to your time after 85? When I look now at your LinkedIn account, it says, you know, you have been advisor on peace building and development of the president of the resident coordinator of the Solomon Islands, and as well in the Philippines and in Lesotho. So in the recent years, you have been obviously abroad as an advisor. At what level were you working then, really? What was your task?
Let me mention a couple chapters, not go into detail, but just so that we may want to refer back to them later. I went to South Africa from 89 to 1995, sponsored again by Mennonite Central Committee, which was expanding its program in international, proactive peace building internationally. And I was sent, sponsored by MCC, to go and be in South Africa, which at the time that I went was still under the rule of the white nationalist government. That gave me experience at a national level. I was a training advisor to the National Peace Accord there. Then I came and taught at Eastern Mennonite University, 95 to 2007. And that was in a program training people, a master's program training people in conflict resolution skills, and our students came from all over the world. And I was a co-founder with me in that program was John Paul Lederach. Urban. I then took an appointment with the UN in Lesotho for 4 years as a peace building advisor there, and followed by another appointment to the Philippines when I hit, and then I hit mandatory retirement, and I've been independent since then, and took a short appointment to the Solomon Islands just recently.
I would be interested, once you said it, you know, you've been to South Africa, you said from 89 to 95, and said you kind of a training advisor to the peace accord. That's what I got. Yeah. And obviously the peace accord between built up by Nelson Mandela and what is his name again?
Depends which one. The old de Klerk was the president at that time, but prior to him was Botha.
Pete Botha, huh?
Yeah.
Pete Botha, yeah. Yeah. So, at what level did you work then? What kind of leverage? What kind of influence did you have then?
Yeah, I was a contributor behind the scenes to the development of people with peace building skills. There was the negotiation process, which was taking place at high levels, and I was never directly in that. But what happened was, as the negotiation process went on, and everyone increasingly recognized there's big changes coming here, and we don't know what, but it's kind of like just taking the lid off, and an enormous amount of violence began to just swept the whole country. It was terrifying. On a Monday morning, you would pick up a newspaper and read that there were 10 people killed in faction fighting in the suburb, in Cape Town area, and 30 out in the rural areas in Natal province. And and then there were always smaller incidents scattered throughout. And one had the feeling that this whole country might go up in flames before they can ever reach agreement. I need to say that what we now know, that many of us suspected back then, but we couldn't prove it, was that there was provocation. There were provocateurs who were actively working throughout this time block the negotiations. And they knew that the best way to do that is to just stir up a lot of chaos. And it was so easy to do, because there was tension and chaos and resentments everywhere. And there were guys coming in balaclavas, just go through a community, shoot up some people, and disappear. And then there would immediately be blaming, and it was happening everywhere. So we were worrying about fires that were being intentionally started everywhere by white reactionaries who were in the police and other locations. So what happened was, people got so worried. There was the assassination of Chris Honey at one point as well, who was the head of the ANC, of Mkhonto we Sizwe, the armed wing of the ANC. People got so worried that the national leaders of all parties came together at one point and said, we have to do something. And the agreement was to establish this organization called the National Peace Accord. And they formed a governing body of high level leaders from the white government, various political parties in the white government. Also, the ANC had, Mandela's group had appointees to it. Inkatha Freedom Party had appointees to it. That was a reactionary black anti-ANC group. And there were business people on this, religious leaders. It was an amazing gathering of dozens of high-level people who had been appointed by political groupings to be there, but some of them themselves politicians, many of them civil society leaders. And this National Peace Accord, the international community immediately stepped up to fund this effort, because the world was watching, wanted to do something, had been feeling desperate. So millions and millions of dollars quickly came in from the international community, the EU and other locations, the US, USAID, the Japanese. I mean, it was just, it was an amazing effort. And a lot of money is like, so now what are we going to do? Have a big organization try to keep out the fires or put out the fires of violence while the negotiation takes place? And there were many different answers to that question. One of them was to do training. And a whole training unit was set up very quickly with staff people in scattered, full-time staff people throughout the country, national and regional and local levels. There were people hired. This was, it's a story that's never been properly told to my knowledge. I would say South Africa set up the world's largest, set up the largest conflict resolution initiative in history because there was such an urgent need and such a big, generous response from the international community to fund this. And it was put up in a matter of a year. And here we had all this, these agencies. And so I was appointed by all political parties as one of a number of people to be on the advisory committee, the training advisory committee. And we did not do the real work. That was being done by people at regional and local levels. But we were gathered to give some oversight to this. And it was really an exciting experience. I felt very closely connected to something that I believed was important. And to this day, I still believe that if that National Peace Accord had not been set up with all those layers of conflict resolution capacity, I don't think South Africa would have achieved what it achieved. There was in time after time after time over a period of many, many months when big killings took place, incredibly provocative, that could have easily triggered violence, which would have overtaken the negotiation process, which was kind of going along, trying to keep this process together over several years. And each time there were people mandated by these local and regional peace committees and who had been trained by people like you and me with some mediation skills to come in and respond and do what they can. And those local and regional committees would get to work. And sometimes in very dangerous circumstances, they had to go and meet people in places that were fraught, were dangerous. And there were hundreds of people who courageously put themselves on the line to do what they believed they needed to do in their community to support this larger project. And, you know, miraculously, one by one, they somehow tamped down the fires of violence and the country got through to the end of the negotiation process and Mandela came into power. That would not have happened without this effort. And
so it was really about getting conflict resolution capabilities into a very different layer of society as much as the bottom where things happen. And so that people who were interested to keep peace and to restore peace have got some skills doing so and got some backing doing so, as far as I understand what you're telling.
It's a success story for conflict resolution and the kind of thing that you and I have been doing. Tragically, when the Mandela government, the ANC came into power, they had all these new people now in political posts and with big budgets and a lot of work to do. And they, many of us thought, okay, now we have this amazing structure. It's there, it's existing. People with experience and vision, they're rooted in their own communities. Now let's see what we can do with this as the new government comes into power. And I don't know the full story, but in the end, the Mandela government looked at that and it's like, well, now we have a government who we have negotiated settlement. We'll move on. They just totally ignored the whole thing and went on. And no financial support, it just all sort of faded.
Ah, so that's a pity. Probably Mandela was too optimistic. As far as I know, during the time of Mandela, things in that time played backgammon on the internet, and I as well chatted with a guy in South Africa, and he was a white businessman, and he was quite frustrated with the ANC, but he said he would never say anything bad about Mandela. It's very interesting. I mean, having this guy in the government, of course, made a huge difference, but a pity that these structures which you helped to build did not persist, because great people die, and you still need some work be done without these great people. Yeah.
Part of what made him such a towering figure was the great personal discipline that was in him, and his consistency, his application of principles of change and possibility for transformation to himself and his own life. And there are amazing stories of him appointing, for example, his hardest opponent, Mangosuthu Buthelezi, to be the temporary president while Mandela went out of the country in the early years of the presidency. That's unheard of. It's the kind of practice of what we need to have a transformed world. It's a human being who was formed, he was formed personally by this vision.
From 95 to 2007, you had this master's program together, co-founder together with John Paul Lederach. I read some stuff about John Paul Lederach and his illicit approach to mediation. Very interesting, I think. And that is a thing, I think, which you mentioned a little bit earlier, that, of course, you started and we all started kind of with this kind of interest-oriented mediation model. This is, by the way, the book which you brought along to Northern Ireland. I nicked it and brought it home to Germany, Getting to Yes.
Oh, nice.
This is from you. You brought it across the...
It's from
you, yeah. It's from 1984.
I've stolen one or two books in myself in my life, so this is now my. I'm officially forgiven for my own thievery.
No, actually, you left it there. You left this and other books like Church Fight. You left several books there, and when I left Northern Ireland a year and a half later, there wasn't yet a big structure where I could leave this book. So I asked the guys from the Fellowship of Reconciliation, what about these books? And they said, well, just take them with you. And so I did. So, but what I really want to say is, I mean, this very well-known structured phase-based model of mediation, working very well in many conflicts on the society level, on family level, business level. However, you are obviously much more focused on these international conflicts and as well as much as John Paul Lederach, as well I know. So I just wondered, how did your practical approach to conflict change? I mean, what, starting as a practical trainer and mediator, how was your work different? Changed by all this time abroad, changed by this master's program which you co-founded with John Paul Lederach. Just interesting how your professional development went.
I need to gather my thoughts on this, because this touches on something that I care deeply about. And I came into this with what I would call a religious calling. I am a faith-based peace builder. I still feel that. The ground of my being is what we call God. What does that mean? Well, that means many different things to many different people, but that's how I name it. I have a sense of being called to this by something that is much bigger than just me, a clump of molecules sitting here, that mystery that brought all of humanity, brought all of the universe into existence, whatever that is, I feel a connection between myself and that mystery, and I feel called by that mystery. Out having to explain it in terms of some kind of mystical awareness that I may feel. To others, that may be my imagination. It may be subjective.
So and you want to use a language which is really common to everybody. Like you would like to address believers as non-believers the same.
Yeah, exactly. In my view, everybody is a believer in something. It's just a question what you believe in, and what you do with that. But still, to me, it's a very important goal. It's an important part of who I am to say, I carry a deep sense of call within myself to explain, figure out ways to talk with you and others about this important work in ways that are meaningful to all of us, and not just in my own worldview. And that's a big challenge. I think it's a very, very good one, because in doing that, we challenge ourselves to find common ground everywhere. And I think that the world would be a much better place if we had a lot more people holding that kind of challenge in front of themselves. So all across my life, whenever I'm excited about something, I have some vision, then I'm asking myself, okay, I feel excited about the possibilities here. How do I frame this in ways that others in this situation could actually feel the same kind of possibility? Sustainable development workers know you can't drop development in from the top. You can't build it down. It's got to come up from the grassroots, and it's got to take root in all those intermediate structures, and politicians need to be involved in it as well. And so that insight, I think, that instinct, that awareness is at the very core of everything that John Paul Lederach has done. And to a lot of people in the world of peace building, that was a kind of a fresh insight. It's like, you know, his middle out approach, for example, people talk about that. And that is an insight that stands on the shoulders of this tradition and the years of human development work that MCC engaged in, and seeing the limits of top-down development, and then figuring out other modalities. Another key aspect of that, I think, is that when you do development work, you realize a key part of what you're doing is you have to listen. You really have to know the people that you're working with. You have to understand the world as they experience it. And you need to work with the existing strengths of those communities and build out from those. If you have an idea that you can come in and, you know, teach this and this and this, and now people have those skills, and then they're going to be fine, forget it. That's not going to, that development won't last. It's got to be connected to the existing strengths and roots of those communities and build out and expand from there, and then it's sustainable. So that's at the core of, Lederach, in my view, basically took principles of good sustainable development and articulated them in a peace building framework and made that accessible. And I see pretty much all of my life work in a similar mode. Lederach was a popularist, and he wrote and took it out there and made it, you know, took the concepts out there. I have not been as active at that level, but I think the same concepts influenced me.
So when working in countries like Lesotho, Philippines, Solomon Islands as an advisor on peace building, What was your practical approach? What was your daily work you were doing there? How just give us a picture of the way, you know, you're coming in as an US American for the guys there. Probably was just an US American, another American, and probably it's not the best start being an American trying to help people. So I was just curious, how did you go about it?
Oh my, now it gets complicated. it was really very hard. I've had three terms in the UN now.
Yeah.
And the Lesotho experience, interestingly, was by far the best and the most rewarding.
Yeah.
The other two, quite challenging and disappointing to me in the end. And I want to step back now and talk about the phenomenon, the reality of conflict in our world and our existing structures for dealing with conflict resolution. We do have an existing body of laws and treaties, alliances, and a UN sort of apex body to coordinate and manage all of this to deal with conflict. Tragically, this whole system was created in a time when the nation state, the concept of the nation state, was new and exciting and sort of innovative and considered the answer to an adequate answer to human ills. And so, I mean, that's a whole big story in itself, the many chapters of that. But that spans more than a century. But the key point I would pick up on is the formation of the UN, which is where I had now some years of engagement with the apex international struggle structure for dealing with conflict. The UN is established with a charter that assumes the nation state as the fundamental building block of how we do things. And it is a gathering of nation states. The UN doesn't come in and work immediately directly with communities. It can only come in by invitation of the nation state, of the government in that country. And, you know, it's governed then by voting members of the General Assembly. So it's already highly biased towards nation state worldviews, all the more difficult because then it has the High Council in the UN, which has the veto power. Five members can veto everything else that it's done. The
Security Council, I think.
The world
it's
has changed. Security Council. Can't believe this. This is where I have a nice excuse of age, you know, which blocked out little pieces of memory that you use every day for in the moments when you need them. It was a good start. It's a great structure for certain things, but the world has moved on. Today, there are dozens of corporations which are bigger than many nation states if you look at their revenue bases, and the world of technology has vast power and its own ways of having influence. There are civic bodies of various kinds. There are religious forces. There are ethnic forces, which are ethnic relationships, and incredible power for all of these actors to communicate with each other, to mobilize, to have influence in the world, et cetera. And the nation state structure is not adequate on its own to solve conflicts. And we have all these, the UN structures are made up of people who are mandated to solve problems which are intricately connected with very influential actors at in the societies where they exist, and often there's regional influences at work. But the nation state actors have to work through this existing structure, and it's just all out of whack.
And what are you thinking of as an alternative? Is it rather kind of getting regional structures to collaborate, or is it rather getting on a worldwide scale, like you're not in one nation world? Or what are you thinking of when you're criticizing this nation state? Which direction are you thinking?
It's a complex problem, and like all complex problems, there will not be a simple solution. It will require a complex solution. So we have to talk about multiple things. I will tell you what I think the single, if someone said, well, you only get to pick one solution here, one strategy, which one would I pick? I would pick the one that I got very intimately involved in with my UN work. Namely, I would pick starting with the UN itself restructure the UN to operate in a different modality. And rather than have the UN so tightly wired with everything to work through its own structures and to work with in accountability to New York and nowhere else, and hire through those structures to mandate the UN to work in a way that takes much more seriously the existing resources of human knowledge and experience within the context where it's working. I was gifted with people who were smart and had a lot of integrity in the UN, who basically said, if we want to help this struggling country of Lesotho to overcome serious conflicts that have troubled it since independence, we have to support the emergence of peace-building initiatives within Lesotho. And Ron Craven, we know you and the way you work, so we're hiring you to go and do that. And I was appointed as peace-building advisor to the UN there to work with that. And I had a resident coordinator, my superior in the UN in the country, who was open to different ways. And the way we did this was to work through the religious leaders of Lesotho, and they had a relationship previously, but it was a fraught relationship. The conflict there is political at one level, but the church denominations had gotten divided themselves, oriented towards competing political parties. So we spent a year in a dialogue and conversation among the religious leaders. National heads of churches were meeting, on a regular basis once or twice a month, and they built a vision, a commitment to try to work together. They convened prayer breakfasts for the politicians to begin to meet together in a situation with an election coming up, and a lot of worries we're going to have violence in the next election, like we did in 1998. We have to prevent this. How could we do that? And the heads of churches convened these meetings. It was not the UN. It was the heads of churches convening a meeting. Wouldn't have happened without the UN being involved in it, because I was there supporting this the whole way, time and energy. We provided money for the prayer breakfasts, but nobody really knew that. It was a meeting convened by the heads of churches that we enabled to happen, and they got all the credit. That's really important, because the international workers so often want me to get credit, or my organization or whatever. No, that's one of the big rules. You got to let the credit go to the local folks. And long story short, many meetings, a lot of committees, sub-forces, negotiation, worked out agreements to support a free, fair, and peaceful election in 2012. First one since independence in, what was it, 68 or whenever. That's locally based peace building that was facilitated by the UN. And if we had a lot more of that kind of, that's the modality that I think could happen. And that could be driven by the UN. Lots of other things we could do for that vision I was talking about, but this is one.
Yeah. Let's me try to summarize to see whether I got it really. So the approach you chose was that you noticed that the religious leaders in Lesotho were closely linked to different concurring parties. And so what you did was to get the religious leaders into meetings like once, twice a month, and help them to influence the party leaders, party people, really to promote a peaceful election there. That was the way, in short. Is that right?
That's right. It's based on the developmental principle. If you want to change, if you want change in a community, look for what's existing there that has resources, build out from it. Applied to peace building, that's what we got.
And I think one of the interesting questions there seemed to me, how do you get the influential religious leaders to join this effort? What was their reason to join, and was their reason to take Ron Krebel and the UN serious?
Yeah, that's complex. One is they genuinely cared. These were people who had seen that Maseru, the capital of Lesotho, had parts of it had burned in the last election because of the violence. They didn't want it again. They wanted to see the country move forward. In addition, it's an example of, okay, the UN, the call, the invitation for this and the offer of my services came from the UN. The UN is powerful. It has prestige. It has money. People want to be on the scene of something that the UN convenes. That's a big contribution that the UN can make. That's one of the ways to use this powerful body, because it has a reputation and it can be leveraged. If this initiative had come from, you know, who knows what, some small service organization or some small religious group, it would have been much harder to get attention. The UN is like, well, yeah, we'll send our top guy, the Archbishop will come to that.
So that was a good start to have a powerful, wealthy sponsor, the UN, with good, you know, with good image. And then, as far as I get, you really sat down, you in person, together with religious leaders. What was that, right? You sat together with them?
Yeah, I did.
So how did you get, I mean, I'm really a practical guy, you know, you probably noticed. I'm really a practical guy, because I think just to make a little detour to Germany today in Germany, we've got about 20-30% of the population who vote for this right-wing party, AfD, which is really racist, which is for good parts are Nazis, really terrible. And like 10 years ago, it would have been impossible to me that this kind of a party would have this kind of you know voters. However, obviously they managed to address some fears and some needs in a way that people vote for them. And I think the big question in Germany, how do you get talking with these frustrated people who vote for the AfD? And I think that is not an easy thing, really. So really, how you said these religious leaders, they saw the suffering of the violence, so they were both powerful and well-meaning, obviously. And but still, I mean, obviously they had to do something which is not easy, like getting a peaceful election. So how do you get them committed to go this way, which I suppose would be risky as well? I mean, as soon as you're kind of a peacemaker in a violent environment, it's risky as well. So how did you all manage to go this way?
It's a big question that you're putting forth now, and it's one that I hold for myself because I also live in a society which is under grave threat from extremist groups who have gained a base we never dreamed they could come. If I had easy answers, I'd be doing them. part of the reason why we have gotten to where we are in the U.S., I don't know the German situation, but it may be similar. Our national, I think leaders at many levels have gotten out of touch with the people that they consider their base and took for granted to be their base. And that is, I mean, this comes back to something that, or it goes to something that we may move to at a certain point in our conversation, namely what I'm really working on now. I feel that part of our challenge is to strengthen the communication and decision-making and conflict resolution capacities at all levels of society. And I'm spending a lot of time, for example, literally years, on web tools that are about building those capacities just between individuals. And I'm only now currently in really beginning to work strategically to raise my own ambitions now to the next level, not just between individuals, but between individuals and those above them and working at that level. So I think that there's a lot of work remaining to be done that for humanity that there's no shortcuts to. That it's like teaching, making literate populations to read. we once had most human beings who couldn't read, and it was recognized we need to change that. And gradually over time, we built structures and we achieved that literacy goal, something that would have seemed impossible a couple centuries ago. We're in a similar situation right now with peace building, that there's a whole level of conflict literacy that we now know is possible, but we haven't figured out the ways to bring it practically into reach.
Actually, I think as well. I mean, looking at politicians, for the first part, I really admire lots of politicians for their courage and for their work. I think they're very often bashed for things which I think it's terrible. However, I think you need as well the basics of politicians, some charisma, some way of, you know, of talking and some way of dealing with things that people feel connected, although these people are so far away in Berlin or in Washington. And I think that's what's missing a lot, really having politicians who can connect on a heart level and you can listen to them and trust them just because the way they are really talking, I think, and the way they are presenting themselves. I think that's really important. And I would love to come back to the little bit easier question of Lesotho. I was really interested how did you go along? You know, you had these representatives of you had these religious leaders you sat together. And how can we envisage your work there? What actually happened, you know, having this first meeting? What did you tell them? I mean, what was the way going forward with those leaders?
Yeah. The process is actually easier than one might think, and it uses skills that ordinary people like you and I build up through our natural living. Realizing that, by the way, was an important one for me because I spent years kind of puzzling over the question, kind of exactly the one that you're asking now. It's like, well, how do you get started? How do you do this? And then having now been through it in a variety of situations, I realized, well, it's actually, it's doing stuff I already know how to do well. It's just, there is a certain strategy though. I would say there are a couple elements in that strategy. A key one is figuring out people, getting connected to people in the situation who actually care about what's going on and who want to make a difference for peace. Yeah. There are always people like that. No matter the hardest group, there will be people in that group who are not the most bitter and the most ideological. It seems like there's not too many of those with some of these groups, I have to say. But almost always there are either people in those groups or people whom they respect who that you can go and talk to.
So how did you find them out? How did you find these people?
In my case, it was that part of it was already done in Lesotho the UN had made some overtures to religious leaders. That's a pretty easy thing to do, especially if you're in an APEX type of organization that is recognized as a significant actor. It wouldn't have to be the UN. There are always organizations in any situation which are recognized as some kind of, I'm calling it an APEX actor, that if you come in the name of that organization, people will at least open the door talk with you.
Just spell out for our German listeners APEX. What does it stand for, APEX?
So in other words, I think it's from a Greek word or a Latin, but it would be the top level. An APEX actor would be any organization that is immediately recognized by everyone significant, a powerful one.
All right. So it's not an acronym, but it's really I understand. So that is what the UN did. They already found out these people who are willing to talk and who were kind of concerned about having a peaceful election. That you had these people there already, and you sat together. And what happened then?
Well, actually, it began. Let me see. The UN had contacted these heads of churches, said to them, look, we would be willing to provide a staff person to support building a preparation for a peaceful election if you would support this. Is this a good idea? And they're like, sure. I mean, you know, maybe it means money for them. God knows what it will mean. It just sounds good. So, and they had these conversations. So then there I am. I arrive. And I go and start meeting with them one-on-one, I think, initially, yes. Okay. It's like, I'm Ron Crable, the new staff person appointed here. What do you think we should do? And, you know, it's an early dance there because if you are coming with the mandate of an APEX organization, people tend to think, all right, he's going to bring a proposal now. He's going to offer us some money or something. You're going to tell us what to do. Yeah. No, I'm coming and saying, so what do you think needs to happen here? What are the possibilities? And then, you know, it's like, well, the people start talking this and this. It's a little awkward. This isn't maybe quite what they expected. On one hand, they expect the UN to come and tell them what to do. On the other hand, they're like intrigued. This is a little different. This guy, he asked good questions. He's interested in knowing what I think. Interesting. So that's exactly what I want.
Very good.
I want them to be intrigued and to be a little puzzled and also to be willing to meet with this guy again. That's enough for the first round. So I made one or two rounds like that. and then a second round, and then pretty soon something emerges and we can get together and talk about it.
Yeah.
It just goes pretty naturally.
All right. So really kind of we're looking, first of all, for them becoming interested because you really were interested in their resources, their ideas, their stories. And it sounds as if you then kind of managed to find some kind of common ground out of these one-on-one meetings, like some common way forward. Or what was the topic of the first meeting, really? How did it go on? Of the first common meeting, I suspect at some time you really sat in a circle and were talking with all of them together. Is that right?
Yeah. Oh, we did. We had many, many meetings that. There's. I want to. The professor and me insist that I lay out a very clear principle here. That's absolutely important. The key principle is, I in that situation have to constantly work in such a way that the heads of churches are getting credit for what happens, not me. The instinct of all external actors in these situations is, well, how can we put together a program that has, UN at the bottom or whatever the agency is, and then we'll be announcing that we're doing this. And, I mean, that's the way you think. And it is the kiss of death for peace building. One of my mentors was Jim Lowy, who was an early American conflict resolution person. He was the guy who was the spark plug for the U.S. Institute of Peace, which is funded by Congress and is an actor here. Jim used to quote a sociologist, Robert Theobald, who had a saying, you can have social change or you can have credit for social change. You can't have both. I think that needs to be on the on the wall of every peace builder. And it takes daily reminders because so much you want to put the name of your organization on top of that peace initiative. If I constantly remember I'm not here to get credit for the UN, I'm here to help these heads of churches do something and for them to get credit for it. Everything's easy after that. Ideas, they come up with ideas. The one that they settled on eventually was they'd like to, it's like, actually, I probably, in all truthfulness, I can tell you, it was my idea that I was aware of the concept of prayer breakfasts that prayer breakfast, a national prayer breakfast, which is used here by Christian evangelicals to to have political influence in the United States. And the religious leaders organize this big breakfast and they invite all the politicians and it's become such a thing. And the media comes at a certain point. And all the politicians go, it's been done for years, and it's just a big deal, and everybody wants to go to the national prayer breakfast. Even these guys had heard of this thing. So I said, maybe you could do a national prayer breakfast with the churches. And they're like, that would work. So
that sounds great. So you made it clear, right? From the start, explicitly clear that you don't want to have the credit, that you're just there to help them find their way through and that they will take the credit. This was pretty explicit, obviously, at the start of your work there. Is that true?
It was not explicitly. It's not like I walk in and say that.
No, but how did they found out?
That is so delicate a topic that you would say that they hardly believe it. And
all right.
It's a way of working. It's attitude of humility. It's a signal that you are sending repeatedly in every conversation. This isn't about me and some proposal that I want you to buy in on. This is having an interesting conversation. And what do you want to do? And how can I help that? Gradually over time, they see the modality. They have to see it in action and feel it. And the trust begins, they begin to see it. They trust you. And then they begin to move out. They hold a meeting and they see that you aren't rushing forward at the end to say, oh, and now, you know, we want to, the UN wants to thank you for participating in our forum. No, it's their forum, period.
May I ask a personal question? What does it make to you being abroad so many years, doing a work which you're truly believing in? However, obviously, it's not very high profile in the sense of, you know, oh, yes, Ron Krebel did this Lesotho thing, but it's really kind of giving other people the reward for all the work you're doing, really. And what does it do to you? What does it mean to you to be so many years abroad doing this work?
Well, this is for me where that sense of calling is everything, because I was never in this because I want to be prime minister. I'm in this because I'm called to do it. That's the most important reward I really need. And I know what I've done. I am at peace with my sense of having done what I am called to do. Sure. I have my longings for recognition like anyone else. They're in me. I have repeatedly felt I've chosen not to act on those. I still sometimes, there's parts of me that want more credit than I have gotten. That's an ongoing issue, but in the end, it's me and my journey of life, and I'm getting through it in ways that matter most to me. And then there's guys like you that come back 40 years later and say, hey, remember? And it had an impact on me. It really means a lot to me to have this kind of conversation. It confirms something.
So as everybody else, you've got like different voices in yourself, one saying, you know, I don't need the reward and I know the good reason why I'm doing this. And then another voice saying, yeah, it would be nice to have some credit for it as well. So it's really an inner conflict resolution you're doing there.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's right.
I think this very, I like this. I think this is very human. Very humane. I like it. Yeah. And what did your family say about you traveling all around the world? Because actually, the work you are doing, I think there's a part in me who would have liked to do it. And another part feels like, oh, my God, you might be very lonesome doing this kind of work, traveling around. How was it? How did it work out for you and your family, you being abroad so much?
Well, that's like all of this complex. The nice tidy answer is that I took my family with me pretty often in that I lived in South Africa for 6 years with my family. Three, my three eldest children have memories of South Africa, went to school there, a couple of them. My son was, one of my sons was born there. And they went with me to India for a year when we worked there. I'm in a second marriage, and in my second marriage, those boys were lived in both Lesotho and the Philippines. And so my family was often there with me. However, as you will know, this is very demanding work. It consumes everything, all your energy when you're in a big conflict, especially when it feels like half the world is watching. And so I realized, I remember in the South African years in particular, when I felt like I could work every night of the week and still not meet what ought to be done, and also finding that, you know, I'm burning out. I could just feel I could not carry this on at the pace that I had been. I developed certain rules of thumb for myself, namely, I think it was, I can't be gone more than one night per week. and one weekend, 1 week per month. And continue doing this. Even 1 week per month is a lot, really, for if you're in this long term. I don't have a high tolerance for travel. I need that stability. So I think self-care is a really important part of this. My children basically are, I think, feel really good about having grown up with a dad who was involved in this. I carry a lot of personal sadness that I feel every day around my marriage breaking up. I'm actually in a second marriage, and my wife, who is Israeli, has returned to Israel a couple of years ago. That's about dynamics which I feel are not related to my to my calling. So, still, that it's something I ponder a lot, and I think. I name those not because I'm happy about those realities in my life, but because holding marriage and family together is a huge challenge in our world. And there are a lot of people in great pain and struggle around that. Many good people. And I guess I name that as a part of my life journey. Because I think it's important that as peace builders, that we do not hold a standard for ourselves of being perfect people. If I had that standard for myself, I wouldn't be able to do the work I'm in. We have to come into this saying we have our own limitations, our own mistakes and failures. The traps that get set for us sometimes, not by some failure, but things we couldn't foresee, whatever it is, we bring a lot of pain and situations into our lives that we are not able to just fix magically with some little communication skills. And we're whole beings and who have a vision. We have pain, but we have vision, and we keep working on
it. Got a lot of resonance to it, and I feel the same for me. I mean, I really coming back from Belfast with mediation, and it was literally unknown in Germany at those days, 1986, when I coming back. It was clear that that was a very, very long way to go, and I could say I worked for 12 years at the theme of mediation before really starting to earn money with it. And it was my parents, and it was as much my wife who supported it and said, we don't understand it all, but we know your enthusiasm, and we know it's a good thing as a general. And so I feel a lot of support, burning at two ends for mediation and really being away a lot for training and for mediations for many days in a row, having two children. And so I really, I owe my wife a lot. I must say, I owe my wife a lot that she supported it. And still, it's still a theme today, like going out there doing trainings and mediation and or staying here and having some more time together. It's still a conflict, still work to be done. And I think what you're saying, this self-care and family care as well, you know, this is a big issue. So thanks Ron for sharing all this. I really feel very close to you, and it's a good feeling to really have this great talk with you, and to follow up what happened with Ron Krabel after I last met him 40 years ago. And I already told you how grateful I am to you. I'm really grateful, and my life would have been different without you. It's no doubt about that. And so thank you for sharing so much about your life and about your work. And I'm sure we will meet again. I'm sure we'll have some time. Whenever you come close to Germany, please tell me. And whenever I come over, I will tell you.
One of my daughters is married to a German man. So I have a grandson who is, his grandparents come regularly from, I forget exactly where they're from in Germany, but I have some family connections there now.
Great. So do tell me if you're around, and maybe we meet in 3D.
That would be lovely. That would be lovely.
Yeah, it would be lovely. So coming to the end of our talk here, is there anything you would like, we talked about these difficult times we're in, and of course we've got a big mediation association here, which I co-founded in 1992, and lots of mediators are troubled about our current political situation in Germany, in the United States, and elsewhere. And what would be your message to people who are really kind of troubled by the state of the world? What would be your word to say to those people right at the moment?
Things that I'm putting real effort into right now are, one is developing, my Style Matters platform, which is a training tool for teaching people basic conflict resolution fundamentals, basics, at an interpersonal level, basically. And I think I keep working on that year after year, even though it's very low level, but I do it because I'm convicted that we have to advance understanding at that level. And the digital tools are an incredible resource on this right now. I'm so excited. That's another whole thing that would take a while longer yet to talk about, but I see now potential, which I always dreamed of, but it's actually here in our hands now, technically, for taking out conflict resolution learning at a very broad level. So that's one of my answers. The other is that I'm working with a Canadian trainer to do training of we're calling it facilitation in large spaces. In other words, this is the skills for working at that, what Vera calls the middle level, I guess you could say. But there are government agencies, businesses, people, police, emergency services, people in all kinds of situations where they are dealing with real live human problems that are not just a conflict between neighbors, but that involve groups of people who are more or less connected, communicating within each group, and they're in competition. And those groups need to be talking and negotiating and building relationships and resolving conflicts. And so we're leading a workshop in November that to train people at that level. And he's finding some interested response in a number of the public agencies to send us trainees to learn that kind of training. I think that middle level is a place to work on right now. We have to raise our sights above the interpersonal mediation. Yep. It's good. Yep. It's a great foundation, but we need people with the ability to help groups, people together, to come together from groups and gather in a space, either digitally or in person, and have meaningful conversation and identify agendas to work on and problem solve and to negotiate. And I think that's maybe one of the places where a lot of the folks that you and I are connected to and are trying to figure out, where can I fit in here somewhere? I think that's maybe a niche
thank you. Thank you for this resource. I will link it in the show notes, this this conflict style inventory, which you're promoting. You've got a beautiful website there as well. I've seen it, and as much this conflict style, this facilitation in large spaces. Well, thanks a lot, Ron, and I wish you all the success for your work, and stay safe and sound, and I'm happy for you still being active in this field.
Thank you so much for the interview. It's truly just nice to see you again as a human being. It really touches my heart to hear your gratitude, and it's been very good for me. It's been a welcome conversation just to reflect back on these years and look back on something that I'm still actually busily involved in. So.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks to you.
Bye-bye.
All right, goodbye.
Das war Mediation Mindset. Konflikte nachhaltig klären. Jetzt abonnieren. Überall, wo es Podcasts gibt und auf YouTube.